we're accustomed to having students of schools be in the audience for oral arguments, because for two years now, the Supreme Court has run with the State Bar a program called Court with Class, and high school students from around the state have been invited to come to Wisconsin and listen to oral argument, and listen to attorneys describe the cases, and listen to a justice talk with the class about cases. So we're delighted that you all don't have to come on to all the way to Madison and come here to the new La Crosse County Courthouse. And the court is here in 1998 as we, the state, celebrates the state's 150th anniversary of statehood, our sesquicentennial. And on May 29th, 1998, there'll be big doings in Madison, and in June, the state will go to Washington, D.C. to celebrate the sesquicentennial. And so we've been telling a story about La Crosse County and the early days of La Crosse County justice. The story we've been telling is that Robert Looney was a judge here in La Crosse County in the 1850s, and Charles Stevens and Joseph French were two pioneer lawyers of La Crosse. And they were very able lawyers, but they had adopted the rough ways of frontier courts. And in a trial before Looney, these two lawyers became very abusive. This story is told for the lawyer's benefit. That's right. Well, he's still smiling. That's the important thing. He thinks smiling will help him.
Repetition for emphasis.
And as the case proceeded, the attorneys became more abusive. And Looney finally put down his pen, and he took off his coat, and he threw the lawyers out of the courthouse. Came back to the courtroom, put on his coat, picked up his pen, and he quietly announced that if he had to, he'd whip every lawyer on the prairie to keep order in the courtroom. And so we've had a different monitor for every case. And the monitor for this case is Ann Walsh Bradley. And she lifts weights, gentlemen. So beware.
Those are secrets, Chief.
Right. Well, I've given away a few today.
And he announced, "They drive me loony."
Right. All right. With these introductions out of the way, we are going to call the second case for this morning, and that's 970441, Rains versus American Family Mutual Insurance, and we hear first from George Brickson, all the way from Madison.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Mr. Bieger, and in tight. I am Ward Richter with Bell, Metzner, Gearhart, and Moore in Madison. I'm here this morning representing American Family Mutual Insurance Company, which is also here in the person of Mr. John Kramer, House of Counsel. I would be remiss at the outset if I did not acknowledge the contribution that Judge Crabb and Judge Shabazz made to this morning's proceedings. But for their indulgence, I would be fulfilling a summons for jury duty in Madison. There is still respect between the federal court and the state Supreme Court. I also feel compelled to comment at the outset that I feel some discomfort standing here physically above this court in making my observations about the case, and I want you to know that I'm not unmindful of the relationship that we have. As I prepared for our exchange this morning, obviously I reviewed the briefs, and in reviewing the briefs, I found myself wondering why it was that the plaintiff respondent, Raines family, argued at such length and so loudly in their appellate brief to this court about the question whether there is a right to notice at all in the context of a settlement between an injured party and an underinsured motorist. There can be absolutely no doubt, I don't believe, about the fact that the insurance company, the underinsured motorist company, the American Family, has a right to notice of the settlement. We borrow our law on this subject from Minnesota in the Schmidt case, which vote in this court in the vote decision adopted. Schmidt clearly enunciates the fact at page 263 of 338 Northwest 2nd that the underinsurer is entitled to notice of the tentative settlement and an opportunity to protect potential rights. They spell out that it is to be 30 days of time at minimum between the giving of the notice and the underinsured carrier taking a position with regard to the settlement so that the insured's right to proceed with that settlement can proceed. Vogt adopts the Schmidt case, and in reaching its decision, the Vogt court at 129 Wisconsin 2nd, page 21, refers to the Schmidt procedure and honors it by saying this procedure gives to the plaintiff's underinsurer the option of rejecting the settlement offer to prevent the release of the tortfeasor and thus protect its right of subrogation.
On those cases, was that because of the clause found in the insurance contract, or was it the authority of this court, or statutory authority? What did we base that on?
This court based that comment on its adoption of Schmidt from the Minnesota law. The Vogt case was a case of first impression to this court, and this court resorted to the law in Minnesota, which had already addressed the issue and adapted the Schmidt position.
Is there in this policy a provision of notification?
There's a provision in this policy which states that the insured shall do nothing to, and I'll quote it rather than paraphrase it, says the insured must sign and deliver to us any legal papers relating to the recovery against the underinsured motorist carrier. Do whatever else is necessary to help us exercise those rights, and do nothing after the loss to harm our rights. That language comes in the paragraph of the insurance policy, which wherein the insured and the insurance company agree between them that the insurance company shall have the right of recovery where it is called upon to make payment. Obviously, that right is hollow if it receives no notice of the fact of the impending settlement, the tortfeasor is fully released, and the company has no opportunity to intervene in the defense.
Let me just say what's bothering me. So now your insured gets into an accident with somebody else, the tortfeasor. The tortfeasor has some insurance, but not enough to cover all of the injuries, right?
Yes.
And your insured settles with the tortfeasor, right? How much did they settle for?
In this case, $850,000.
With the tortfeasor?
Yes.
Okay. They settled with the tortfeasor for $850,000, and there's additional injury over and above $850,000, we're assuming, right?
Yes.
Okay. And so now the insured comes to you, the insurance company, to which the insured has paid premium.
Having already settled with the tortfeasor.
Right.
Yes.
And says, and releases the tortfeasor, right? Which means nobody can go after that tortfeasor again, right?
Yes.
Okay. And now it says, look, I really, you know, $850,000 is a lot of money, but I really have $3 million worth of damages. And for the moment, we're going to assume that, right?
Right.
So I bought insurance for you to cover just when I hit somebody or get hit by somebody who's underinsured. And now I would like you to pay me the difference between $850,000 and the $3 million up to the amount I bought. How much did I buy from you?
$300,000.
So, I want you to pay me the $300,000, right?
Yes.
Okay, you don't want to pay them.
Seems to be the case in this instance.
Right, so you don't want to pay them, and so you're going to say, I'm not paying you because you didn't give me notice. And so my first question to you is, what difference does it make whether I gave you notice or not?
You have promised to give me notice.
Okay, I broke my promise, and it's a little white lie.
Well,
unless I hurt you, right?
$300,000 white lie.
Yeah, but out of $3 million, it's not much, you know. And the American family's a big company. It pays a lot of claims. $300,000 is a small amount of money. But, I mean, let's just stay with you. I have broke my promise. I agree. I should have done it. Are you harmed?
Well, it depends on the circumstances of the case, of course, doesn't it? And
yeah, so in this circumstance,
it begs the question that we're here about today, with all due respect to your question. The issue that we have agreed between us that whether or not there is prejudice is not the issue. The issue is whether there is an inquiry as a threshold matter.
But you're not going to say that every breach of a contract releases the other party. I mean, that's not the law in the United States, I don't think. I mean, there are a lot of breaches that are not going to release you from performance. You think this is a breach that will, regardless of whether you're hurt.
We have situations rampant through the law where there comes a point that this court, our legislature, has drawn lines. Statutes of limitations are an example that comes readily to mind. The whole process, we're here at the third level of court to consider the issue in this case. There has to be finality at some point. We are in the process of defining where that finality will be in the context of the underinsured motorist.
Well, surely, though, Mr. Richter, in the case where the injured has collected all of his or her injuries and has not notified, there's no effect anyway, right, with respect to American families?
If
they're not coming after you.
Yes, by definition, there's no underinsured.
So aren't you really saying that when they come after you and you have not been informed and therefore able to participate, there is, by that very fact, i.e. ipso facto, you want to use Latin before you use English, you are injured?
I couldn't have said it better. You know, what we are talking about is depriving the insurance company of the chance to assess a right that the insured has agreed the insurance company is entitled to pursue.
Oh, but Mr. Rick, you've just switched into prejudice. Your argument should be, regardless if you're hurt or not, you think that the insurance company doesn't pay. I mean, suppose I had a case where you're not deprived at all. The guy is judgment-proof. You agree that he's 100% negligent support teacher. He's paid up everything he can pay, and you agree that your client, that your insured is $3 million. You're not hurt at all. Could investigate it till the lakes freeze over.
I believe, running with the theme that has just been offered by Mr. Justice Steinman, there is inherent in not being informed of the fact of the settlement prejudice. There has to be prejudice because the opportunity to investigate has been taken, notwithstanding the fact that it has been promised to us.
But what if, long enough to switch gears and become an advocate?
Thank you for warning me.
Yeah. What if, following along with the Chief's example, they have settled for the limits of the procedures? Of the tort fees policy, and the tort fees doesn't have a nickel. So now where is your harm?
We have actions being filed in our courts in volumes. I heard a lot of reference to empirical propositions in the immediate preceding argument. This is another one of those empirical questions. But we have, I think we're all aware, a great many actions being filed solely for the purpose of obtaining a judgment, even in situations where the claimant creditor knows that there is no immediate prospect of payment, solely for the purpose of preserving the right to enforce the judgment if, as time goes by, a party inherits money, wins the lottery, there's a change in their circumstances otherwise that makes that judgment enforceable.
If they had received notice, what would have been available to your client to do?
Well, in this case, we have as a defendant the tortfeasor who committed the wrong here, Mr. Elson Peter, who was driving a truck for a dairy. And as a result, you have a situation where we have $300,000 at stake and a ostensibly viable defendant. Obviously, there are many situations, such as the court has been posing to me here, where the underinsured motorist is driving around with the minimum limits policy from some high-risk carrier, barely able to make their premium payments, and they don't have anywhere with them.
Well, under the Court of Appeals decision, don't you have an opportunity, or if I ever understood the opinion, that the insured here is going to have to prove that there's been no harm to you, right?
Yes.
But you don't even want to go back to the trial court.
I don't want to go back to the trial court. Obviously not. And it brings me back to the point I was making earlier. We have to draw a line somewhere. And if we are going to follow the rule that has been announced by the Court of Appeals in this case, where we will be is, first of all, on remand, we will be faced with a question which isn't answered as to what constitutes prejudice. Is absolutely any imaginable deficit sufficient? The mere loss of the opportunity to go take a judgment and hold it against the possibility of a change in circumstances? Or, a question that isn't addressed by the Court of Appeals, must it be substantial prejudice? If it must be substantial, what do we then define? How do we define substantial? $300,000 is a lot of money, but if it's a billion-dollar insurance company and a multi-million-dollar claim, is the loss of a chance of $300,000 substantial? Where do we bring conclusion in a situation where the insured has already agreed with us that we have a right to recover? And in a situation where we have, as a very fundamental premise of our entire system of tort reparation, the notion that the party who has caused the harm is the party that should ultimately be held responsible for what they have done.
Counsel, so it's your position that that since you did not receive notice, regardless of prejudice, regardless of who has the burden to show prejudice, that there is no recovery.
That's correct.
What about actual notice? What if you had actual notice? Not from your insured.
In other words, somehow we had learned...
Sure, another insurer copied you in on something that indicated so you had notice, but no procedure a la the Minnesota case or a la the certain contract, but you had actual notice. What about that?
Let me first, in answering that, distinguish what you have asked me from this case. In this case, we had litigation pending between Mr. Raines and American Family at the time that he settled with the dairy and their insurance company. In the course of that litigation, Mr. Raines had made no claim for underinsured motorist benefits, and in fact, on the contrary, had communicated with counsel for American Family that it appeared that the insurance carrier for the dairy was acknowledging responsibility and had adequate limits to cover the claim. The lawsuit that was the precursor to this one, the lawsuit that I'm referring to, included a challenge by American Family as to whether it owed any coverage at all because the Raines had not timely paid their premiums for their policy. That was resolved against American Family on summary judgment, and the case then settled, and American Family abandoned its appeal on a very substantial issue because the entire litigation was being resolved.
Okay, well, part of the record.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes.
But I get back to my question.
Yes.
You are arguing, as I understand it, for what I would call a per se rule. Insured doesn't give me notice. That's it. I don't care. I don't care if there are any consequences that I, as an insurance company, endure. I don't care if there's any prejudice that I sustain as an insurance company. Insured doesn't give me notice, and that's it. My question is, what if you have actual notice, not from the insured? How does that fit into your per se rule?
I believe what you then have, Justice Walsh Bradley, is the Minnesota situation. We have essentially two rules in Minnesota. We have a rule in Minnesota from the claim case where Minnesota addressed a situation in which the insurance company was given absolutely no notice. And the court said that the failure to give any notice whatsoever without inquiring into prejudice ended the insured's right to make a claim. On the other hand, we have from Minnesota the situation that you're posing, which is the Bauman case, B-A-U-M-A-N-N, in which the insured had an accident, brought suit against the insurance company responsible for the liability carrier for the tortfeasor. That was State Farm. State Farm had $25,000 limit. In the course of that litigation and before settling it, the lawyer for the insured wrote to the underinsured carrier reporting the fact that they had brought suit, that State Farm had minimum limits, that the damages appeared to exceed the coverage and that they anticipated making an underinsured motorist claim, and finally that a demand for the limit of State Farm had been made. There you have what Minnesota appears to deem a substantial compliance with the notice requirement, but in that case, Bauman proceeded to make a settlement without taking that one final step and giving notice before signing the release. There, what the Minnesota appellate courts held in that different situation is that there has to be proof of prejudice before the insurance company can be excused from payment where it is given substantial warning. But even in that circumstance, where the insured has still failed to give the notice, but they've given ample constructive notice, Minnesota says that we are not going to put the burden on the insurance company to show that there is prejudice. In fact, we aren't merely going to put the burden on the claimant. We are going to go one step further and say that there is a presumption of prejudice, even under those circumstances, but it's rebuttable.
Can I,
Mr. Retcher, why should we go that far? I understand certainly the argument that you've made that the burden ought to be on the insured to demonstrate that there's a lack of prejudice. But why should we go so far as taking the approach of presumptive prejudice?
Because, as we've discussed in answer to several questions already this morning, there is inherent in the agreement between the parties in the contract a right to the insurance company to protect and an obligation on the part of the insured to protect that right. There is inherent in one party unilaterally foreclosing the other party from its right, a notion of loss, and there is an obvious loss of opportunity to protect that goes with the interruption of the process by settlement without notice. There is inherent in the scenario that we are describing here, loss.
What is it? Can I just
go ahead.
What does it take to overcome that presumptive prejudice? In other words, what would have to be shown by the other side to overcome the presumption?
As I understand the Bauman case, the insured would have the burden of proving by the middle or lower standard of proof, by the greater weight of the credible evidence to a reasonable certainty in our context here in Wisconsin, that this presumption of prejudice did not, in fact, result in an actual prejudice.
They give a jury instruction?
They did not.
We all give a jury instruction that there's a presumption of prejudice.
The Minnesota court, the Bauman case, does not hand us instructions that they propose to be given on either the burden of proof or the presumption.
Think you give an instruction on a rebuttable presumption.
We have had in Wisconsin in times past instructions on, for example, the presumption that a deceased exercised due care. And I believe there was also one about the fact that accidents are unavoidable that we've abandoned. But I do not believe that there is law for the proposition that there can be no instruction on a matter that's a presumption.
Mr. Richter, would you just sort of practically take us through what it is we're talking about? So what we're talking about is somebody, a plaintiff who's had some kind of accident, sues another party, and is deciding whether to take a settlement or not, right?
Yes.
We're talking about. And that party, that plaintiff has some insurance that also includes underinsured motorists.
Yes.
You are saying when the settlement's offered and the plaintiff's thinking about taking it, what procedurally has to happen?
What has to happen is and has been known in Wisconsin since 1986, long before this case.
Describe it. What happens?
They write a letter to the insurance company.
The plaintiff writes a letter to the insurance company.
Pro forma at this point, and it says we had this accident. We have these damages. We have a motorist who has limits of only X, and we propose to accept those limits.
And then what happens? Is there a long delay? Is
30
what,
days.
And what happens during those 30 days?
The insurance company has 30 days in which to do one of two things. Either substitute its own money for the money of the tortfeasor's liability carrier, thereby preserving its right to go against that liability.
So if they were going to settle for $125,000 with the tortfeasor, the insurance company can say, no, we're going to pay the $125,000.
We write a check for $125,000. We retain the right to take that $125,000 back from the liability carrier and the right to pursue the liability carrier's insured for the excess. If we do not elect to substitute our money, then we have to waive our right to subrogate. And we do that consciously with the benefit of 30 days time to, and the insurance companies usually are doing this well before that, investigating whether they believe it's worth investment of their assets to do that.
Okay, and then in terms of collecting from you underinsured motorist coverage, how do they get that? I mean, they've settled for $125,000, and you've either waived your right to subrogation or you've paid the $125,000. What happens to the rest of it? Is that claim against you at that point?
Typically, it's arbitrated. It depends on the provisions of the insurance policy. One way or another, if they can't agree on it, it's either arbitrated or it winds up in
the court. So it's a matter of simply telling the company we're about to take a settlement and we're going to make a claim against
it. That's all there is to it at all.
So why didn't they do it here?
I have no idea. Except to say
was
that...
Was there a lost case? Was the perhaps standing in their way and then it got changed? Or am I doing it the wrong case?
I know that in this case, before the settlement was struck, we had been advised by plaintiff's counsel, and this is in our appendix, a letter establishing this, that they did not believe they had a claim in excess of the limit.
Because of the state of the law, may or may not be what they thought.
No, what we were told was that they did not believe their damages threatened the limits of Kenny Deere.
So the notice isn't just an accident happened, but rather we're contemplating a settlement.
Yes.
And they, according to you, led you to believe that they would not be coming after you because you can't share it.
That's correct.
You treat that the same as no notice?
Yes.
The notice of a claim is important.
Yes, and we proceeded to settle and give up rights to appeal and challenge coverage as a result.
Now, if the plaintiff here was willing to settle with the Part B insurance company for less than the policy, say $100,000,
yes,
do you still have the right then to forward the $100,000 and to... Well, tell me what you do on the
in that case, the policy says that the obligation to pay underinsured motorist benefits does not arise until the limits of the tortfeasor have been exhausted. There would be no right to underinsured motorist coverage in that event.
Mr. Richter, you want us basically to adopt and continue to follow the Minnesota approach as set forth in Baldwin, is that correct?
In Plang. Plang is the case that is on all fours with our facts. From Minnesota. That's the case where there was no notice whatsoever.
No notice, no recovery.
No notice, no recovery.
Is Klang the case also that talks about the presumptive prejudice?
No. That's Bauman, okay. Where the insured gave substantial notice, and even there where they gave substantial notice, and the insurance company was constructively on notice that there was going to be a claim.
So you want us to follow Klang to some extent and Bauman to the extent of presumptive prejudice?
If you limit your ruling to the facts that are before you, you will follow Klang and simply hold that where there is no notice, as there was in this case, there is no right to recover.
We don't have to address if you adopt your position to stand for compliance because we don't have that issue.
You're correct. My thanks, sir.
Thank you, counsel. You have time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Justices, English visitors, opposing counsel, my name is Matthew Beeger. This is Martha Height. We represent John and Mary Rannis. Let's talk about the practical effect of what's going to happen here. We're lawyers. We read decisions. If you set out a rule that says you must send a letter under vote or else you lose your right to insurance, it's going to happen in the future. Where this case is going to be important is for that person who is seriously injured. Tortfeasor comes to him, the insurance company comes to him with $25,000 or the limits and says, look, we
$25,000 or the limits.
$25,000 limits.
Okay.
Let's make this a hypothetical. Comes to him with the $25,000 limits and says, look, you're badly hurt. We're going to pay you the limits. We agree that we're at fault. Pays person the limits. Person takes it, goes to their lawyer and says, yeah, I've already, the liability insurer, probably the person doesn't use that term. Person who hit me has already paid me their policy limits, but I carry this UIM coverage. Can I go get some more money now? Well, no. The Supreme Court says you can't. The Supreme Court says before you took those limits, you should have gone and consulted with an attorney who could have told you what the case-written Supreme Court law is, that you can't take it. And it doesn't matter whether the insurance company was hurt at all by your taking it. It doesn't matter that this person didn't have more than that $25,000 of liability limits to their name to pay you. You're SOL. You cannot get that. And that's unfair.
But it doesn't matter then what the contract says either.
Well, let's talk about vote. And vote stems from a contract provision. It's the contract provision that Mr. Richter referred you to. is a contract provision that guarantees that you will not prejudice the insurer's right of recovery. And what Bolt did is it created a safe harbor and says, look, if you follow these procedures, we're going to find that you have not violated their right to recovery against this third party. If you don't comply to Bolt, that doesn't necessarily mean that you have that Bolt itself is substantive law that you have somehow violated. You just do not get the benefit of that safe harbor. You may well be in breach of this policy provision by prejudicing your rights. And Chief Justice Abramson pointed out what I think the key thing is here, which is why are we going to give insurance companies protections that we don't give to other contracting parties? They want to rescind a contract, to toss out their rights under the contract on the basis of non-performance, on the basis of breach by the Ranises or by a party. You can look at what our pattern jury instruction says for rescission for non-performance. 3076, a contract may be rescinded by a party only if the other party has breached the contract in a substantial manner so serious as to destroy the essential objects or purposes of the contract. That's the standard that contracting parties in our state have held to.
Well, isn't it an extremely rare circumstance when the underinsured insurance company is not prejudiced?
I would think that it would be the vast majority of the cases that they suffer no prejudice whatsoever.
But again,
prejudice, there's two issues.
And define prejudice while you're doing this, because I think that...
I think there are two things that I think are somewhat confused. I think the normal standard would be materiality, which is essentially what I just read to you, the pattern jury instruction, that this is a breach that is so substantial that it destroys the essential object of the contract. I think prejudice is simply that it's harmful, injurious, or damaging in some manner to the insurance company or their rights. Okay? Now, we can argue about prejudice and whether it's usual or not usual, but the question is, regardless of how frequent it is, the first thing we have to address is, are we even going to get there? Because I think we would acknowledge that there are some cases where they aren't prejudiced, and I would say they're the vast majority. Mr. Richter would disagree, but it really doesn't matter from the standpoint of the first question, perhaps. But I'll get to that question now, and I think that it is very seldom, because we're not talking about prejudice in the standpoint that, you know, we weren't able to go out and interview witnesses until 2 years after, and maybe they lost their memory. This isn't notice of a claim. This is the opportunity to substitute their draft. That is what they've been denied. And they have to show that they have been prejudiced by the absence of an opportunity to substitute their draft so they could pursue this tortfeasor and try to get that money back.
By drawing
their check.
How else do they preserve their subrogation rights if you settle with the tortfeasor and you give a complete release? What's left?
Nada. They have lost their subrogation.
Isn't that why this court took the position it took in Bolt and based that on Schmidt?
As I understand it, the reason the court took the position it did in Bolt is that you're the tortfeasor's insurance company. You want to pay your limits. Prior to vote, the argument could at least be made that there's no way that I can take your limits. Even though you're willing to pay your limits, I have to go to trial and prove up my damages in order not to prejudice the insurance company the underinsurance company by taking the limits and giving the release. What vote did was give me a safe harbor, which says there is a mechanism by which I can take that money, not destroy the insurance company's subrogation rights if they think they're actually worth something and if they want to exercise.
Wasn't Bolt protecting both sides? It was giving the insured the opportunity to get the check, and it was giving the insurer the opportunity to protect its subrogation rights and proceed if it desired.
Absolutely.
Why should we move away from Bolt?
I don't want you to move away from Bolt at all. I think the Bolt procedure is a good procedure to follow.
But you want us to read Bolt as not being mandatory, do you not?
No, I want you to read Bolt as not having the consequence that if you do not follow the Bolt procedure, you lose all of your rights under the new IM.
How is that different than telling us that you don't want it to be mandatory?
Sure, you can have something in the contract. You need to follow what is in the contract. You breach it, I mean, that's a mandatory provision of the contract. That doesn't mean the contract is necessarily thrown out the window. I think vote is a good procedure to follow. I think most, if not all, attorneys will follow vote. But the fact is that, you know, not everyone who gets money from a liability insurer is going to be an attorney. And there may be some attorneys out there who don't do much of this work or for some other reason falls through the cracks that don't give notice. And the question is, what happens then? Granted, there's probably been a breach of the right of recovery section of that policy. What then is the effect of that breach?
I just want to make sure I heard you right. Your position is denial of the opportunity for subrogation rights is not prejudice. Is that what you said?
No,
I misunderstood, but I thought you indicated that the underinsured motorist covered carrier will be denied their opportunity to subrogation rights when the plaintiff is settled with the tort feature. But I thought you were indicating that wasn't prejudicial.
I don't think it's prejudicial as a matter of law. If there is no, if they would not have substituted the draft, if they would not have preserved the subrogation rights themselves.
Well, that's the litigation as to whether they would have done that or not, you think, in terms of assessing the prejudice, that there has to be an absolute file as to whether the insurance company would have opted to substitute its draft and proceeded into court with it?
There has to be a decision as to whether they would have done that.
Well,
who the burden is on and what the presumption is.
Let's just take the example you gave. So the guy is in the hospital and settled out for $25,000 and says, oh, it's great to be in my hospital. And then he realizes one hospital expenses him more and he's permanently injured. And so he now wants to look at his own insurance policy. And you find out you didn't give notice and he signed a release. Right? And that's the example. So, it comes to me, and now I'm his lawyer, and I say, if the court holds your way, or say the Court of Appeals is affirmed, we can collect $300,000 from American Family if we can show, and you're going to take the burden, right? I'm going to take the burden. My clients can take the burden of proof if we can show there's no prejudice, right?
Under the Court of Appeals decision.
I don't agree with that.
No, I don't.
Okay. Under the Court of Appeals decision, we're going to show that there's no prejudice. I don't care even if we shift the burden to American Family. All right. Now, the tortfeasor has got jillions of dollars. Jillions. Just happens to not like to buy insurance, so got the least amount. So American Family says, look, the guy's got jillions of dollars and you sold us down the river. I'm prejudiced, says the American Family. Don't you think the American Family's prejudiced?
I think in that circumstance, you'd have a tough time to show the absence of prejudice.
Okay.
You might have a policy that they never substitute drafts. I could pick some far-fetched...
I think it's irrelevant whether they substitute drafts. I mean, whether they do or don't, my client has signed a piece of paper that says they don't have a choice anymore, and they might have made this choice, and they're prejudiced. So now I get hit by somebody who's got $25,000 coverage and doesn't have a dime, doesn't own a house, owns no property, doesn't look like he's a very good prospect. On the other hand, he plays the lottery every week. So American Family's going to say, hey, as a matter of form, you know, we just take out a judgment. You never know. You might hit it lucky. You might marry somebody who has money, and they're going to be generous. You never know. Why isn't American Family prejudiced?
American Family isn't prejudiced because it is not prejudiced to have deprived American Family of a false choice, a choice they would not have made. And the reason why I am saying this is because we have choices in our life all the time. I could have come down and stayed at the Fleabag Motel or at the Hilton, but somebody says, no, Mr. Beagle, you can't stay at the Fleabag Motel. Have I really been deprived of something in the sense that it prejudices me? No, because that is a choice that I was not going to make anyway. In this case, assuming that we get a chance to prove it, because that's all we're asking for. All we're asking for is a chance to prove it, and if they were prejudiced, so be it.
What are you going to do, depose them or send out interrogatories and say, avoid your cases that involve a notice under underinsured Under what circumstances do you waive your rights, and under what circumstances do you pay the check, and is that what you were planning to do?
I think that there was, I'm not sure if it is part of the record, I believe it is, there was extensive discovery submitted that was not responded to because of the court felt it appropriate to take up these issues first. And I think in this specific case, you'd say, look, pre-Matheson, pre-Kuhn, those cases on the reducing clause, did you, in a case where you had more in liability payments than the amount of your underinsurance coverage, ever choose to substitute your check for the check of the liability insurer? And I think that that question would probably come back no. And I think, I don't know if it is dispositive or not, but I think that would go a long way toward showing the absence of prejudice in this case.
What percent of the time does an insurance company exercise subrogation?
All I can tell you is anecdotally, and I think in my about 8 years of practice, I may have seen it once or twice. I don't think it is a very frequent occurrence, but it does happen in the circumstances that you posit where you have an underlying tortfeasor who owns a substantial business or the insurance company has some reason to believe may have substantial assets. Unfortunately, at least up in our part of the state, those don't seem to be the people who get in the accidents the most often.
Mm-hmm. The prejudice to you is failure of the company to exercise subrogation rights, therefore there's no prejudice.
If I could prove to the fact finder in the court, or if American Family has the burden, if whatever party has the burden, shows that, look, even had they gotten the notice, they wouldn't exercise their subrogation rights. They would have said, take the limits and we'll go ahead and arbitrate the UIM policy. There's no reason that the Ranises or any other folks should be denied coverage in the absence of prejudice.
Is that what Bauman meant by prejudice? I mean, did Bauman use your definition of prejudice, and did the other cases cited by the Court of Appeals use your definition of prejudice?
I don't know if I've given a formal definition of the term prejudice up here, but I think I'm using it consistently with the way that it has been used in those Minnesota cases, in that it is harmful to them and prevents them from substituting their draft, from protecting their own subrogation.
Those cases talk about the history of an insurance company making decisions on other claims, and that being sort of the milestone as to whether or not they're prejudiced by not being able to make this claim?
None of the cases cited have come to the Court of Appeals after any sort of fact-finding hearing on the issue of prejudice. So none of them really talk about what evidence is going to go into that sort of hearing. I do think there's a mention that the financial conditions of the tortfeasor may be one thing. But in general, they simply concentrate on who is going to have the burden to prove prejudice, remand it, hasn't cleaned back up through the system, saying, here is the evidence that was presented, and here is what a jury or a fact finder decided based on that evidence. So I think it's standard evidentiary rules would apply. Anything that is relevant to showing whether or not the insurance company would have likely substituted this check and preserved its subrogation rights is fair game to put in front of fact finder.
Mr. Baker, what do you think of the approach of presumptive prejudice? Do you think that's a reasonable approach?
I think that not only do I think presumptive prejudice is important, but I think putting the burden on the insured is unreasonable. And let me tell you why. When I went in this age playing around with the computer, I typed in the phrase proving a negative. And essentially that is what the Court of Appeals is forcing the insured to do, is prove a negative, prove absence of prejudice. And I have not found any Wisconsin case that looks favorably on proving a negative. Sure, there are statutory provisions that have things with burdens, but if you look at any other area of the law, somebody for a mental commitment having to prove they're not dangerous.
How about proving notice of claim, failure to give notice of claim? Doesn't the injured party have to show no prejudice?
That's a case of statutory interpretation as opposed to the common law contract law that's being formulated by this court. This court was interpreting what the legislature did. It apparently interpreted what the legislature meant,
for prejudice to be handled that way. And in fact, I think it's very clear in the statute that it is spelled out. I don't know how many lawyers there are in the legislature now or at that time, but it is a difficult thing to prove a negative, and I would hope that a body of lawyers making common law would not force a party to prove a negative.
Well,
it simply is a very difficult thing to do that you don't require people to do in other areas of law. You require the other party to prove a material breach. Again, I don't see why the insurance industry gets an exception from the standard rules of contract law.
Well, because they didn't receive the notice from the insured that they're entitled to. That's why, isn't it?
Well, any other party that had a notice provision under a contract for delivery of goods or something, they'd still have to prove material breach. They don't get a free pass. They don't get presumptions that there's prejudice, presumptions that there's damage or harm. It's only the insurance industry that's asking for these special contract rules, and nobody else gets the benefit of it.
So I just looked up, finally found, 903.01 that deals with presumptions. And it says that presumption recognizes common law or created by statute, and I assume this is the common law. The prudent statute of statutory provisions that certain basic facts are prima facie evidence of other facts. Here, the basic fact is no notice, and it's evidence of the other fact of prejudice, if that's a fact. Imposes on the party relying on the presumption the burden of proving the basic facts. Now, here, the American family, they didn't get notice. But once the basic facts are found to exist, the presumption imposes on the party against whom it is directed the burden of proving that the non-existence of the presumed fact is more probable than its existence, which is, I think, what happened under the Court of Appeals decision. And I wonder whether it makes any difference whether you call it a rebuttable presumption or you put the burden of proof on you. Either way, I think you get the burden and you do it by the ordinary preponderance of the evidence. Now, the thing that bothers me about what you say is prejudice is on page 7 of the slip opinion, the Rains argue the insurance carrier has the necessary evidence to demonstrate whether they've been prejudiced. And a rule requiring the insured to demonstrate the lack of prejudice requires proof of a negative. And the Court of Appeals goes on and says, while these points are well made, we perceive no unique information available to the carrier in regard to the question of prejudice. And yet, if your definition of prejudice is right, it is unique. They know how many times they do or don't pay the check. They know what their internal operating procedures are in evaluating when they will write the check and when they won't. So I think that the Court of Appeals, from my reading of the case, doesn't see prejudice the way you see it.
Well, I think they at least don't necessarily see the evidence that's likely to be submitted on that issue in the way that they see it. But again, I'm not sure that issue was ever directly in front of the Court of Appeals or that they were thinking of that when they penned those lines. Because I think there certainly is some information that is specifically within American Families' control that will be relevant, perhaps not dispositive, of that issue. Going back to your comment on the burden, again, the Court of Appeals decision notes that in jurisdictions are equally split on this question about who should bear the burden of proving prejudice or proving material breaches, as I've called it in this case. And we can certainly argue about who has three more jurisdictions to their credit. But again, I think what you need to get back to on this issue is, are we going to create a rule that's different from standard contract law? If so, why? What are the policy reasons that would lead us to create a different rule that they don't have to prove material breach here? Do they have information that they can come forward with and show a claim of prejudice that it would be easier for American Family to do that than it would be for the Rannises to do that? And they do. They have their own internal guidelines. They have their own historical data on how often it is. And they perhaps have the other policies and factors that they would consider. And then you have to look at what is the policy factors on the other side that would lead you to have the Rannises bear that burden. And it doesn't seem to me that there's any policy reasons to put the Rannises witnesses in the point of proving a negative, proving absence of prejudice.
Isn't the real issue whether or not that's substantial? That the right, that the denial of the right in the contract to pursue subrogation rights against the tortfeasor is a substantial breach. And if the court believes that that is a substantial breach, then the question is prejudice. And let the party who breached the contract show that there is no prejudice. I mean, if the issue is whether that's a substantial breach in the first instance, then it seems to me your argument makes some sense. I mean, I just see it one way or the other. Either it is a substantial breach to say insurance company, this was a, you know, it's not, we're not talking about crossing a T to denying a right to pursue a statutory subrogation or an equitable subrogation right in court against the tortfeasor, whether that's a substantial breach. If it is, then it seems to me it makes some sense to do what the Court of Appeals did, which is say to the plaintiff, you're going to have to show that there's no prejudice. It was substantial, but if you can show that there's no prejudice, then we're not going to let them deny the claim. Maybe is that really the...
And we've used terms like substantial breach, material breach. I don't know if...
But your argument is that the plaintiff, that your client has not materially breached the contract. And so why does it make sense to put the burden of prejudice on them?
My argument is that my clients have breached the contract.
Not materially.
Right, the question is that. Whether or not it's material, whether or not, because I think materiality relates to whether or not it actually had a harmful prejudicial effect on the other party to that contract.
If it's stated that way, then there's only one issue. It's always prejudice because you don't find a substantial breach or a material breach unless it's prejudicial. So, you know, you can start out saying, hey, it's a breach, but we're going to go look at prejudice. Or you can say, it's a breach, but the real issue is it a substantial breach? And so you put, no matter which way you go in the analysis, in the start or the end, it boils down to, is it prejudicial, the party against whom there has been a breach? And then it goes down to the issue of, what do we mean by, and you can use the words prejudicial or substantial or material, but it all boils down to that, as I see it. And I think as you see it.
I agree. I think that if you do not take the position that failure to abide by the bolt procedures, boom, that's it, then I think the analysis is as you would set forth. You eventually get down to the issue of prejudice and who bears the burden on prejudice and whether you have standard contract law that the insurance company has to show a material breach, or whether you have some sort of shifting burden where they come forward and show breach that they didn't get notice, and then the burden shifts to the insured to come forward and show somehow that there was an absence of prejudice. And I'm saying that that's a very difficult thing for an insured to prove in something that generally in the law we don't require people to prove negative. We don't say, look, you were in an automobile accident, this person caused it. We're going to have a presumption that there was some injury, but we're going to let the defendant rebut the presumption. We're going to make the defendant prove the absence of an injury. It simply doesn't seem to me like a logical and common sense way to structure burdens in the case, and certainly not the way we do it in a normal contract.
Can't you obtain from the insurance company to discover what you say they possess, such as do you ever get a check in advance in order to buy the claim?
They probably know a little bit better where to look, but yes, I would hope that we could get that information through discovery and be in a position to produce that information.
Is there any practical difference between a presumption, a rebuttable presumption, and making the insurer show lack of prejudice by the contents of evidence? Is there any difference? Is it the same thing?
I think that presumption, start with the presumption that there has been prejudice and need to rebut that. Under the preponderance of evidence, you start with no presumptions, and it's our burden of coming forward with evidence to get that 51% of that preponderance of the evidence that there has been prejudice. As a practical matter, I think it may affect somewhat who bears the burden of coming forward with some evidence, but I don't think it's a significant practical difficulty, and I see no reason why there should be a presumption. As the Court of Appeals did, instead of just simply
In both cases, whether it's presumption or not, at least in the Court of Appeals opinion, the insurer would have to show by the preponderance of the evidence that there was no presumption. Is that what the Court of Appeals is? And if there was presumption, you still have that same burden?
That we would have the burden of overcoming an existing presumption in
by preponderance of the evidence.
And maybe that's a legal, technical thing that we're more interested in than the jury would be interested in. We can start on a level playing field.
How does that affect anything, though? If in each case, what the plaintiff has to do is show by preponderance of the evidence no prejudice. And if you don't, you lose.
What we have to do is show by a preponderance of the evidence no prejudice, and there's no reason to have a presumption.
Well, there. What would the presumption do? Let's assume there's a presumption, and you show by preponderance of the evidence, you win, right?
I would assume that if you showed by the preponderance of the evidence, and that evidence including the instruction that was given on the presumption, yes.
That's the kicker, whether there is an instruction on presumption. If there's no instruction, you wind up in the same place as soon as you bring in a modicum of evidence. If there is an instruction of presumption, then the insurance company has the benefit of, without putting in any proof, that presumed that they've been hurt.
And the fact finder would be told that, and would start out with that instruction or that presumption. Again, whether that makes a practical change, it might make some. Therefore, the most we assume that they're prejudiced. Let me just briefly conclude. I think what we have here is an insurance industry asking for special dispensation for standard rules of contract law. Vote is not a part of the contract. Vote is simply a safe harbor from the right to recovery and cooperation parts of those policies, and it says how you can accept money and not run afoul of them. If you breach the contract, I don't think they're entitled to void the contract for breaches which are merely technical and don't result in some sort of prejudice or harm to them. And finally, I think the burden should be placed on American Family and on all insurers to prove material breach as it is on other contracting parties, because the evidence is within their possession, the policies that they use are within their possession, to go forward to show that they have been harmed in some fashion by this failure to get the consent. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Richter?
I have but two very brief points. I do not believe, and I do not accept as correct the proposition that's been advanced, that the insurance industry is seeking some special protection in its contracts that are not afforded to general contracting parties. We have, in this contract, as in every contract, a requirement of payment of consideration. If the insured fails to pay a premium, the contract is breached, and we don't have to come in and prove that there is some prejudice. There's no inquiry about prejudice. The mere fact of failing to comply with that provision of the contract is evidence of breach and entitles us to declare the contract void. The question is whether the provision pertaining to subrogation and notice of the opportunity to protect that right is a comparable provision of comparable significance to the contract. The right to the premium is a right to recover money as a part of the consideration for the promises that the insurance company has made. Similarly, the right to subrogate against responsible tortfeasor is a right that the parties have agreed belongs to the insurance company to pursue and recover money. Just by virtue of the fact that there has been a breach of that provision, there is an end to the contract, just as if there had been no payment of the premium. And it is significant that the parties view the right to subrogation as being so important to their relationship that they have included it in the contract, notwithstanding the fact that the insurance company would have the common law right without that provision in the contract to subrogate against the party responsible for the loss. So I believe the fact that they have included language which says, and I quote, if we pay under this policy, we are entitled to all of the rights of recovery of the person to whom the payment was made against another. And then they go on to conclude that the person to whom they're making the payment must do nothing after the loss to harm our rights. It is by agreement of the parties, the insurance company's right to make a decision whether or not it is going to preserve its subrogation rights by substituting its money. It is not